Nation, 6:20 p.m. in the theater, please announce. I don't know if somebody is impersonating Peter Sorensen or Peter Sorensen is impersonating somebody else, nonetheless, we'll find that out at 6:20.
Is he related to James Sorensen?
I don't know. Maybe they'll name the theater after him if he is. I don't know. I'd like to welcome you to our subject today, our panel, That Which Is Just and Equal, Toward a Mormon View of Labor. Organized labor is a subject of some interest to me. I'm a convert to Mormonism who has a family of coal miners on one side and carpenters at Utah Copper Company on the other side. And in the coal mining side of my family, we were always taught that the other two members of the Godhead were Delano Roosevelt and John L. Lewis. Later I learned that wasn't true. In the last few years, I've spent a great deal of my historical study studying Utah politics and particularly the socialist movement in Utah in the early 20th century. I've discovered as a part of that research that the LDS Church was, in the early part of this century, clearly both anti-socialist and anti-union, and in many ways that legacy has continued throughout the century down to this present day. In this session today, we've loosely taken our theme from the book of Colossians, chapter 4, verse 1, which talks about justice and equality. We're going to explore some attitudes toward organized labor specifically and the philosophy of work generally from within a Mormon perspective. Among the questions to be considered are these: are there similarities between LDS theology and the principles of the union movement? Why has the LDS Church been perceived as anti-labor? Are we getting feedback from this? You can't hear it because I can. Remember that. What challenges face Mormons who seek to combine a dual allegiance to church and union? Is the union movement, is organized labor as a movement, still relevant to the nature of work in late 20th century America? Those are some of the things I hope that we'll discuss. We have a very able and knowledgeable panel with us today to discuss this topic. And I'm going to introduce the panel in the order that they'll speak, and then hopefully we'll have plenty of time for some questions and answers and dialogue. As I look around the audience, I see several people here who have as much to say about this subject as our panel does, and I hope they will join in when we get to the question and answer part of the panel. Our first speaker will be Kent Powell. Kent is a historian at the Utah State Historical Society, the author of, among other things, The Next Time We Strike, Labor in Utah's Coal Fields, 1900 to 1933, one of the best studies of labor in the Carbon County coal fields, and just a number of other articles and papers and books. He's got a book coming out from Utah State University Press later this fall, an able, prolific scholar. Warren Broadhead, on the end, is vice president of American Federation of Teachers, Utah, and he indeed teaches social studies at Highland High School. And finally, Esther Peterson is just Esther, if you know her. She has one of those people that it's hard to know what to say in terms of an introduction. She's been an educator, a union organizer, a government official, a consumer activist under Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and Carter, a winner of a presidential medal. I don't know where to stop. We're pleased that she's here, and you'll hear some more from her later at the banquet tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the time over to Kent. We'll proceed in that order, and when we get to the question and answer period, we look forward to your participation. Kent.
Thanks, John. I'd like to excuse myself as soon as I finish the paper. It's not that I am afraid to stay around for the questions, but of all days, my only nephew picked to get married, it happened to be today at 6 o'clock. I'm just glad it wasn't 5 o'clock. And John consented to allow me to go first and then said, go ahead, that you've got at least one or two friends here that will cover for you and help out. And without putting Helen too much on the spot, I said I wouldn't mention that she would handle all of my questions for me. But many of the ideas that an early introduction to labor came from Helen as I came up from Emory County and picked a topic for my master's thesis, which was on the coal fields. Chaz Peterson immediately said, you need to meet Helen, you need to talk with her about her research and her writing. And that has been one of the most rewarding experiences of my entire life, the the support that she has given me, not only as in my scholarship and research, but as a friend too. So I appreciate that very much. Appreciate John and his putting together this panel, because I think it's a very important one, and I think the topic of labor certainly deserves consideration here at Sunstone. I prepared about a 15-minute paper that I'd like to read, and then, if you'll help pack my bag and head out the door and leave you to enjoy yourself. As we grapple with the evolution of Mormonism, it is critical that the relationship of Mormonism to organized labor be explored and better understood. Mormon attitudes toward labor were, it appears to me, second only to such issues as polygamy, a theocratic government, the Pioneer Trek, Western colonization, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre in shaping outside perception of Mormonism during the early decades of this century. Furthermore, Mormon attitudes toward labor paralleled, if not parroted, those of conservative elements of American society during most of this century. Mormon attitudes toward labor were at once both a reflection of the Americanization of the church and the means by which the church became accepted by the establishment. In my remarks today, I would like to examine some aspects of the question why the LDS Church has been perceived as anti-labor. I believe the use of a simple hierarchical model that considers the attitudes, expressions, actions, and interactions of three groups does provide some insight into the question. And these three groups, as I would define them, would be: one, the general authorities and state or regional business community, educators, and professional leaders, both Mormon and non-Mormon. In the second group, I would look at local LDS leaders such as state presidents, bishops, local community leaders including local businessmen, teachers, professionals, newspaper editors, other clergymen, and those who could be looked upon as the respectable or the middle class spokespersons for the community or area. And in the third group, then, I would include the workers, the lower class, the proletariat, whatever label we would like to give to them. But within this third group, then, I would include several subgroups, including active Mormons, nominal or inactive converts, and children of active Mormons. My father would certainly fit into that category as an inactive child of active Mormons. Immigrants, non-Mormons, those whose experience was entirely agricultural, and those who moved back and forth between agriculture and industry, including mining, and those who had become urbanized either in the cities of Salt Lake or Ogden or mining camps like Bingham or Hiawatha. A constant question is, were, and if so, how did Mormon attitudes resemble or differ from those of non-Mormons in the same group? And a second question is, assuming that general authorities were usually opposed to organized labor, to what extent did local leaders pick up on those anti-labor sentiments and incorporate them into the meetings and programs at the local level? Finally, again assuming that anti-labor sentiment of the general authorities was conveyed to local leaders, to what extent were these attitudes accepted or ignored by the populace? In an attempt to apply this model to an examination of Mormon attitudes toward labor, I would like to look for a few minutes at the 1903-1904 Utah coal miner strike, which had its focus in Carbon County when coal miners struck in the fall of 1903, demanding higher wages, the abolishment of certain abuses by the coal companies, and recognition of the United Mine Workers of America. The strikers and miners affected by the strike can be divided into two groups and a couple of subgroups as well. The two major groups then would be the Anglos, or the Native Americans, not Indians, but those who had been here 10 years or longer, I suppose, and secondly, the immigrants. Included in the Anglos then were the Mormon coal miners, many who were converts from the coal mines of England and Wales, Mormon farmer miners who worked in the mines during the winter and returned to their farms in the spring and summer, and other non-Mormon, non-immigrant miners. The immigrant miners, however, were primarily Italian miners who arrived in large numbers during the preceding decade and were concentrated in the camps at Sunnyside and Castlegate, and also a group of Finnish miners located at winter quarters in Clear Creek in the Schofield area. The strike and further expansion of the coal industry in Utah brought in other immigrant groups, including the Greeks, the Slovenians, Croatians, Serbians, and Japanese after 1904. The 1903 strike then marked the first major attempt by the United Mine Workers of America, which had been organized in 1890, to secure unionization of the Utah coal miners. The effort in Utah was part of a larger effort directed at organizing the Colorado coal miners. Both Utah and Colorado comprise District 15 of the United Mine Workers of America. The Utah strike succeeded in closing down the Castlegate mine and greatly curtailing production at the other mines in Sunnyside and the Schofield area. Some Mormon miners joined the strike, while others did not. Mormon authorities and the Mormon-owned Deseret News gave attention to such issues as the legitimacy of the strike, whether Mormons should join the United Mine Workers of America, whether the Utah National Guard, which was comprised mostly of Mormons, should be called out during the strike, and most important, whether Mormons should answer the call by coal companies for miners and thus become strike breakers, or scabs in the words of the union men, in the eyes of those miners out on strike. I think it's important to remember that Mormon leaders were concerned more with the interests of Mormon consumers than with the special interests of coal miners, labor unions, or to some degree coal companies. A major reason that Mormon authorities came to be perceived as anti-labor is the fact that they felt they were acting in the best interests of the consumers, that is, the temporal interests of its members. I think this is illustrated in a Deseret News article critical of the coal companies at the onset of the 1903 strike. In anticipation of the unionizing effort by the UMWA and its attempt to sidetrack the strike express as it moved from Colorado along the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad into Utah, coal companies gave miners a 10% raise effective November 10th. However, the 10% raise was accompanied by a 25% increase to consumers, and the Deseret News righteously charged, quote, King Coal has added another step to his throne and which the consumer must mount in order to approach him, end of quote. In the early days of the strike, the Deseret News gave a fairly balanced treatment to events in the coal fields. The newspaper reported attempts by the coal company to use armed guards to prevent union organizers from meeting with the miners and serving, quote, eviction notices that were handed to tenants from the end of a rifle, end of quote, on one hand. On the other, they exposed threats to men who refused to join the strikes, such as a letter printed in the November 24th issue, a letter that had been sent to one miner named John Knudsen, quoting, "You are hereby notified that if you scab here anymore, you better be buying a coffin, and that pretty soon too. And if you ride that rope tomorrow or go down into the mine, you will be hung tomorrow night," quote from the Deseret News. However, in addition to the growing perception that Mormon consumer interests were best served if organized labor did not secure a foothold in the Utah coal fields, and the belief that the strike best served the interests of lazy, non-Mormon, anti-American Italians, who, according to the Deseret News, were the most enthusiastic and vociferous strikers, and, quoting again from the Deseret News, have refused to amalgamate with Americans or learn the English language and have lived with the intention of getting all out of this country they could and returning to their native land of olives and dirt, end of quote. Well, it was a combination of factors then, pro-business attitudes, anti-foreign sentiments, the threat of violence, coupled with the apparent violation of individual free agency, that unions seemed to demand, which influenced Mormon sentiment at the highest levels against the United Mine Workers of America, specifically, and I think against organized labor in general. The issue of violence led to the decision of Governor Heber M. Wells to call out the entire Utah National Guard, a force of 399 men and 34 officers, on November 24, 1903, the same day that quote appeared in the Deseret News. General John Cannon returned from a tour of the coal camps on November 23rd to report that a state of lawlessness existed and the stage was set for a bloody confrontation between strikers and coal operators. While the National Guard tried to maintain the appearance of neutrality, at least in the beginning, most guardsmen, in the words of a soldier from Nephi, considered their assignment, quote, to protect the coal trust property and the lives of its employees from a lot of anarchists and lawless people, end of quote. The spark which would ignite the powder keg of violence was the attempt by coal companies to bring in strike breakers, and it was the issue that led organized labor in general and United Mine Workers in particular to charge that, quote, the Mormon Church has commenced a fight to annihilate union labor in Utah, end of quote. This charge was levied after Salt Lake State President Angus Cannon announced during a meeting in the Salt Lake Tabernacle that employment was available to anyone who needed a job in the Carbon County coal fields. Letters denouncing the Mormon Church were sent to UMWA President John Mitchell, AFL President Samuel Gompers, and were published in union journals, including the United Mine Workers Journal. The letters denounced the Mormon Church and called for organized labor to join the fight to keep Reed Smoot from being granted his Senate seat. The Fuhrer prompted a telegram from the LDS Church First Presidency to Gompers and Mitchell, and this was published in the Deseret News on January 4, 1904. Quoting from that telegram then, "Reports have been circulated that the Mormon Church had used its influence against organized labor and had endeavored to fill the places of union strikers with non-union men. We hereby emphatically deny that the church over which we preside has taken any such steps or issued any instructions on this matter. The whole story originated in a false newspaper report." End of quote. The fears of adverse publicity prompted Joseph F. Smith and his counselors to shun an open admission of involvement. Church records nevertheless indicate that they had instructed local authorities to support the company's strike-breaking activities. On December 2, 1903, H.D. Williams, president of the Utah Fuel Company, wrote to President Joseph F. Smith explaining that Bishop John Potter of Sunnyside had sent Brigham Gould to Emory County to recruit men for the Utah Fuel Company. Gould's efforts were nullified by Jack Coombs and David Wilson, two striking miners who followed the company representative and argued that he was misrepresenting actual conditions. Williams' request that President Smith reassure the people of Emory County about the good intentions of Bishop Potter and Brigham Gould. The request was honored. In a letter sent to Reuben G. Miller, president of the Carbon Stake, the First Presidency clearly supported the company's strike-breaking efforts. Miller was instructed to telephone or write the bishops of his stake at once to assure them that the statements of the Utah Fuel Company and its representatives could be relied upon, and that those who wished to work, quote, would do well to pay whatever to the statements of Coombs and Wilson, end of quote. The strike-breaking effort succeeded. Striking miners admitted that a large number of farmers had arrived in the coal fields looking for work and concluded that Mormon authorities were fearful that if the union succeeded in Utah, that the corporations would close the mines. In a confidential letter to H.G. Williams written on January 25, 1904, the First Presidency congratulated the Utah Fuel Company on its victory and offered advice on how to prevent further trouble. Williams was counseled to hire sufficient guards to protect the company's property and, quote, keep the lawless men under control, end of quote. In order not to be, quote, obnoxious to the strikers, end of quote, the guards were to be discreet men who were not to make arrests outside company property. The letter explained that this new advice was being offered because, quote, you are aware how anxious we were that you should not be forced to yield to the demands inspired by outside agitators, which the strikers made upon you, and we are still anxious that the victory won may be complete, end of quote. Although union leaders were not privy to the confidential correspondence between the First Presidency and Williams, charges continued to be made nationwide that the Mormon Church was anti-labor and was an argument used by the United Mine Workers of why it was so difficult to meet with success in Utah. The United Mine Workers of America was not recognized in Utah until 1933. If most local bishops dutifully passed on word of work in the coal fields while men were out on strike, at least one bishop, Bishop Horsley of Price, rendered Christian service to the strikers by collecting food for striking Italian miners who were arrested in the early morning hours in their tent colony at the mouth of Price Canyon and transported to Price, where they were incarcerated inside a bullpen for several days. Bishop Horsley made the rounds among ward members and collected food and took them to the strikers. Time does not permit an examination of the attitudes of non-Mormons toward the strikers. The non-Mormon Salt Lake Tribune, for example, was at least as much, if not more, anti-union than the Deseret News. Nor does time permit an analysis of the economic and other motives of Mormon farmers who replaced striking miners in the coal fields or who accepted jobs as company guards. One of these was my own grandfather, who, in an interview with him just before he passed away, said, "We had been living on practically nothing, and now the coal company offered us $5 a day to go serve as strikers. And while we really didn't feel one way or the other, the $5 a day did make a difference." And for him, at least, that is why he was perceived as anti-union. But to conclude with a partial answer to the question, why has the LDS Church been perceived as anti-labor? I think the experience of the 1903-1904 strike indicates the church, as defined at the three levels of general authorities, local authorities, and Mormon farmers who became strike breakers, I think it clearly indicates the Mormons were anti-labor, or at least anti-organized labor, for some or all of the following reasons. One, business or the coal companies were perceived to best serve the Utah consumer and employment interests. Two, church authorities were fearful of an adverse effect on Utah's economy if organized labor succeeded. Three, labor organizations were perceived as violent, foreign-dominated, and anti-American. Fourth, organized labor seemed to promote the unwanted influx of non-Mormons and, worse, immigrants who would not or could not be assimilated into American, to say nothing of Mormon society. Fifth, the business and social backgrounds of church leaders suggested their sympathies would lie with corporations in the upper strata of society rather than the working class. Sixth, the implication that labor insisted that it was justifiable to violate, as the church understood it, the individual's free agency by requiring the worker to join a labor union as a condition of employment. This was a factor held against organized labor very much. And finally, seventh, labor organizations demanded loyalty from the rank and file in ways that seemed to threaten Mormon loyalty in the ways that business did not. The final point then, that by being a member of a labor union meant that you couldn't give your complete support and dedication to the church, whereas that argument was never made if you were a businessman. And so there was something, looking at it from the labor class, of a double standard. Well, again, I appreciate the chance to share these thoughts with you and apologize for not being able to stay for the question discussion period. Thank you.
As John mentioned, I'm a teacher at Highland High School, and I'm with the American Federation of Teachers. That's often in the news media portrayed as the other teachers' union or the minority teachers' union. So maybe someday that'll change. We hope so. Some of us do. I joined AFT because it's AFL-CIO. And it took the organizer about 5 minutes to explain AFT to me, and I just had to interrupt him and say, "Where's the membership card? I'd like to sign up." And I explained that I have a union background. So most of my discussion here today will be about shop floor factory organizing, because that's where I come from, and that's what I did before I became a teacher. When people ask me, why did you become a teacher, given all the drama and the publicized hardships of that profession, I say job security. And I'm not kidding, because in my previous life, that job security often wasn't there, particularly if you were dangerous like I was and were on a union organizing committee. So I want to address that aspect of labor. Labor activity basically falls into a couple of areas, and one is organizing, and that's what I'm going to talk about. The other is servicing contracts, and that means grievances and negotiations, bargaining. That's the most publicized aspect of labor activity. The other one is political activity, because what goes on in politics has an immediate impact on the lives of millions of working people. So I'm going to go after an explanation, or at least a description, of labor organizing from the shop floor level. Of course, I've gone on to bigger and better things. Right now, I'm vice president of the Central Utah Labor Federation, which is one of the central labor bodies. And sometimes, of course, that makes me feel like a minor bureaucrat. But other than a meager car allowance that I get from AFT, I don't have any paid position, so the state of my labor soul is relatively pure. I don't know about the other soul. We'll have to see, I guess. And I would like to talk about unions and their relationship to ethical values, including Mormon values, by way of addressing another question. And John Sillitoe mentioned this in the introduction. One of the questions he said we might address is, are unions really relevant to today's late 20th century labor force? And Mr. Powell just gave you a good example of what kind of labor relations there were 50 and 100 years ago in the bad old days. And the question is, well, now employers are more sophisticated and sometimes are even nicer, and certainly we have protections that workers then didn't have. You know, we have the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. We have the right to organize in the first place. Collective bargaining is a legal right, and so on and so forth. We have Social Security, unemployment compensation. We have workman's comp. And, you know, now that we've accomplished all that, we don't really need unions. So I want to go after this question by telling you about two types of campaigns, organizing campaigns I was in, and use those as examples of how we might think about the question, are unions relevant? And the first one was in Colorado, where I used to live, and this place was involved with outdoor recreation equipment, backpacks, sleeping bags, skis and tennis rackets. This was back in the 70s. Their customers today would be called yuppies. So were their management. And management, I think, in this company, thought of themselves as very much like their own customers. They were hip and cool, and they had a volleyball net in the parking lot for their employees, so their employees really shouldn't complain about low wages. Now, so if that's the case, if we have all these hip and cool management people directing a workforce, making up-and-coming, upscale recreational equipment, then why should anybody complain? And the reason they complained and started a campaign is over the issue of piece rates. And piece rates are a way of increasing production and, from the worker's point of view, increasing pay by putting out more production. So the faster you work, the more money both you and the company make. And the difficulty with that situation was that without a union and without any contract, without any language regulating these piece rates, management people would realize that some of their employees who had a lot of seniority and got really good at their jobs were making too much money because they were putting out the production too fast. So the way to handle that situation is not to get rid of these employees, because after all, they're really good at what they do. We don't want to have to train new people. So instead, we simply cut the rates so they can keep working at the same pace and make less money, and therefore the company makes more profits. This is 1970s, and you know, what we would say is late 20th century America, in an outdoor recreation hip company that had a volleyball net in the parking lot for their employees. So that was the issue there. And I might add that they cut the rates without any warning. They would have a company meeting, and they say, well, we've cut the rates. Or if they didn't want to face the wrath of the employees, they would simply post a notice, and that was enough. So be it. Now, the other place I would like to mention is right here in Salt Lake City. And this was a job that I got right in the middle of our last horrible recession, the one in 1982 in that time. And I came here looking for work, because it was the big city, and before I'd been in a little town in the mountains and there was no work. And this place was very high tech. It's still here, so it still is very high tech. It makes lasers. And they hired me at $4 an hour. And the first day I showed up, somebody asked me how much I had hired on that, and they said, I told them, and they said, how come he started you so high? I met one woman there who had not been in the workforce for many, many years because she was middle-aged and been raising a family, good Mormon, and therefore, you know, felt that her duty was at home. But because of economic necessity, she took a job, and the employer tried to hire her at 50 cents less than the minimum wage. And she didn't know about the minimum wage law, so she said, okay. On my first day at work there, a person told me at break that you better not make more than $5 an hour, because then the boss will find a way to get rid of you, because that's too much money. Now, the interesting thing about this boss was 100 years ago, because he flaunted his wealth, of which he had a lot. He had something on the order of $12 million, so I was told. The way we noticed his wealth was that he had about 6 or 7 brand new, very expensive cars, such as Porsches and Mercedes, and he would drive them around and show them off to those people who were making $4 an hour or less. The other way that this person, this boss, was a throwback was that he would have what we would call temper tantrums and fire people for minor infractions and occasionally even at random. And an example of that is that in the shipping department, they had 3 people in the shipping department, and among other things, they have to wrap a plastic wrap around the wooden crates that hold these high-tech lasers. And as the president, the boss, was walking by and he saw a relatively new employee doing that, he didn't like the way he was doing it, and he said, you're not doing that right. And the guy said, well, how shall I do it? And he didn't answer the employee. He just walked into his office and told personnel to fire not only him but the whole shipping department. He didn't like him. Now, the thing is, you might say, well, that's unfair, it's unjust, and it's wrong. But it's legal. Because without a union contract to protect you from things like that, you're at what they say, they call it working at will. There have been some, I know we have an expert here in the law, so I'm not going to try to pretend I know more than he does, but if I'm wrong, tell me. There have been some cases recently where this working at will has been challenged on the basis of an implied contract, but I don't think that has gotten into setting precedents. So I'll hold that for later. The wages were low. There was an atmosphere of terror in the plant where you never know when you were going to get fired. You never knew if you went in there if you're going to have your job at the end of the day, literally. This is high-tech Salt Lake, 1983. Now, the other thing is, of course, is with a lot of new women in the workforce having to go to work there because of economic necessity and trying to find daycare for their kids, there was a problem with family health insurance. And if you wanted a family health coverage, they would take up to $150 out of your meager paycheck, and so most people simply couldn't afford it. So most of those women did not have health insurance for their families, particularly if they were single women, and so therefore they were running a real risk, as you might imagine. So what to do about all this situation? Well, organize a union and get some protection. This is 1983, but so what? We need one. There is a labor law covering elections. It's called the National Labor Relations Act, 1935. I don't want to speak to the people who already know about this more than I have to. Does anybody besides Mr. Sandak know about this law? How it is? A couple. You mind if I explain it? In very simple terms, the government recognizes that every worker has the right to organize into an association or a union to represent his or her interests in negotiations with the employer on wages, hours, and working conditions. This is now a legal right. Before 1935, it was a power game. You could get away with it okay, but if you couldn't, you didn't have the right. And it sets up an election process, which on the face of it is very democratic and fair. The union presents its case, the management presents their case against the union, and then you have an election to see who wins. The law specifies certain things called unfair labor practices, which both management and labor and the union cannot do to influence the outcome of an election. And examples would be outright bribery in the case of a union, or a promise of a promotion, or a promotion based on the premise that this person would actively campaign against the union. A union cannot violate rights of employees any more than management can, but far and away, most of the violations occur from management. And I have yet to see a campaign, I've been in a number of them as a helper as well as an employee, where there were not a host of unfair labor practices. The most common one seems to be the threat to move the plant or shut it down. And the reason that's a threat today is because that's what companies are doing. They're going overseas, or they're going to Mexico, or they're going somewhere where there's a history of anti-labor and low wages. And if you go into a plant today and you say, let's organize a labor union, the first reaction you'll get from your fellow employees is, oh gosh, we'll get fired, or oh gosh, he'll shut the plant down. Now, the law specifies you cannot do that if you're management. You cannot say, if you bring a union here, I'm going to shut the plant down. You cannot actually shut the plant down either. But it happens, and they get away with it. And this is a high-tech late 19th century, 20th century America, where this stuff goes on. I remember after my third campaign, I the original leaflet, I said, here's what management's going to say. They're going to say, the union's just after your dues money. They're going to say, you have to go on strike even if you don't want to. And they're going to say, you're going to ruin a wonderful personal relationship we have in this plant, and we will no longer have the opportunity to, as an individual, discuss your problems with management. You'll have to give it to a third party. We said that they were going to say this, and the next day management came out and said that. So it gets to be pretty predictable. The thing that is getting predictable now, which is frightening, is that management has discovered that the best way to defeat a union campaign is to simply go out there and commit all these unfair labor practices and then just let the process go forward legally with the National Labor Relations Board and let it take years and years and years. It's the delays that are really killing labor organizing campaigns in the last 10 years, especially. Because, after all, if you have a National Labor Relations Board, which is supposed to supervise the process and to make it fair and just for everybody, that are political appointees, and a pro-management, anti-labor administration appoints those who are pro-management and anti-labor to the top positions, then obviously you're going to have a harder time winning cases if you're a labor union. And that's what's been happening. There might be some settlement. That's what happened to us. We lost our election, and 3 years down the road, before our first regional hearing, let alone going to Washington, we got a cash settlement. I went out and bought a car, and that's the last time I'll ever do that for cash. It's from labor's point of view, and this is, again, from our point of view, a political factor rather than something that's built in necessarily to the process. So it's like, go out there and commit these violations, fire people for organizing, shut the plant down, threaten to shut the plant down, and who cares if you know it's illegal, but so what? Because it won't come into there won't be a decision about this for another 4 or 5 years maybe. What happened in this laser place, besides our settlement, is that we got half the people were fired without notice, and what management had done, so we were able to prove 3 years later when a supervisor came in to our rescue in testimony, was, he said, let's make a list of all the people who are for the union and we'll fire. And that's what happened. And they said it was an out-of-work layoff. They didn't come out and say, honestly, we're firing you for union activity because, that's too blatant. So they said, gee, work is down. We have to lay you off. Too bad. Just so happened everybody laid off was pro-union. And so that killed us. We had an election in a plant that the same company owned in Colorado. We won that election, and the company challenged it, but we won the challenge, and they had negotiations, got a contract, and they shut the plant down. And he moved it to Idaho under a different name. So we followed him to Idaho and started organizing there, and he shut the plant down. The workers came to work one day, and there was a notice saying, plant shut down, too bad. And you can imagine the great amount of high-paying jobs there are in Idaho that people could flock to after they've been summarily laid off from this one company. Besides all this, I would like to I think I've set the stage now that unions still have a place in late 20th century America because despite the veneer and the image of sophisticated labor relations, and we don't have as much violence, of course, there are still practices that are, for one thing, illegal and questionable morally. We're talking about people's livelihoods. Now, why is this going on? Why has management been doing this, besides the fact that they figured they could get away with it politically? And the answer is the restructuring that's been going on as we've been dragged into a global economy. American workers are now competing with people in Mexico who make $3 a day, or people in South Asia who are lucky to make $1 a day. And some of the old industries, like the garment industry, were the first to feel this. And in response to that, communities like Salt Lake are saying, let's get high tech in here, protect those jobs. And then an example of what happened there is Atari in California, Silicon Valley, and 600 workers were summarily laid off as the plant moved to Taiwan. And I wonder about the census that seems to be in Salt Lake City about bringing high tech, as if that's going to mean job security and high wages for our workers. I haven't seen that, and we'll just have to see what happens. As far as a question of values goes, I am a union person not because I want to make a lot of money, and not because I want wonderful health insurance and that kind of thing. I'm a union person because it fits my values. And I think this is true for virtually all workers who get into a union and see what a union really is, as opposed to what they watch on TV or read in the papers or hear about from friends. We hear about the Teamsters and the corruption and so on, or we hear about strikes and violence and so on. But when you're in the situation, you really open your eyes. Now, if I were an organizer, again, I'd do the same thing I did when I was really organizing. If I were playing hardball and all I cared about was getting the dues money the way management says that we want, and winning an election is what I need to do so we can go into the contract negotiations, and I would have to say, what's the most important thing for winning an election? And the answer is an in-plant committee. To have a group of dedicated, hardworking individuals in that plant who do the organizing in the plant for you, because by law, union organizers, staffers, cannot go into a company's plant and just talk to the people. It's against the law. So the only place staffers can talk to people is outside the plant, and usually that's done at their homes or maybe on the street or the sidewalk and so on. But it's the people in the plant who really carry it for you. And so what kind of people are you looking for to be on that committee? Now, at the Laser Place in Salt Lake, interestingly enough, the people who were the most effective on our committee and the people we wanted on that committee were not the ones who were the loudest moaning and groaning and complaining about the conditions in the plant and saying how much they hated the boss. Instead, we looked for people who were what we thought were stable and were good workers, not the ones who said, I hate this job, I'm going to be late, or I'm not going to work hard. We looked for hard workers and stable individuals. And because this is Utah, many of those people were good, active Mormons. And this is theatrically great. Many of the people who were most opposed to us were vocal anti-Mormons who were talking about how the church is so horrible. And the people who were good, many of the people who were good active Mormons were on our committee and were dedicated union folks. We even had one person who was a bishop. Now, I'm not going to say this is going to hold for every organizing campaign in Utah or anywhere else, but this is what I found in my experience. And the question comes up, well, weren't they giving away their free agency on this? And I'm going to suggest to you, although I'm no expert on doctrine, that free agency, a person's free agency is given up no more by joining a union than a doctor's is by joining the American Medical Association or a lawyer's is by joining the American Bar Association, or for that matter, a business person's is by joining the Chamber of Commerce. It is a group of individuals who have a common interest and organize and are active in furthering their interests. And, you know, that's what's wrong with that. I think also a case could be made that right to work, and here I'm editorializing like crazy, that right to work is not necessarily as much an expression of the desire for free agency as most people might think, in the sense that, at least according to Elder McConkie, whose book I perused the other night, that a person, like in the church welfare program, is not supposed to take a free ride. And isn't a person taking a free ride if that person gets all the advantages of a collective bargaining situation, such as the wages, the job security provisions against random layoff or layoff and recall by grievance procedure, and so on, without participating in the maintenance of that organization through union dues? And I'm not going to say I've decided the question for you. I just want you to think about it. I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm going to look forward to your questions. I just want to close by saying I'm honored to be in the presence of Hester Peterson, who I find out is a longtime organizer for the American Federation of Teachers. So I'll use that as my transition.
That's brings back all kinds of memories, because it was one of the first organizing jobs I had. I was teaching school in a very swanky private school for women and got converted to the labor movement and decided what I needed to do was put my energies in my own profession. I wasn't a garment worker. I wasn't a whatever it was. So I organized, and boy, did I organize. I got three locals. That was not bad, was it?
Huh? There's three better than I've done with
it. Well, maybe. I think when I came, I was hoping that the undercurrent here would be that things are better today as far as the church and the labor movement. But I gather maybe they aren't. Is that right?
Not for the teachers, no.
What?
Not for the teachers. They went on strike again.
They went on strike again.
They went on strike in 63, Ball State, Utah, first time.
Well,
they went on strike again last year.
The whole attitude is seen. I'm a great believer in the labor movement. Let me just be very firm and about that. And I think the best thing for me to do today is just tell you a little bit of some of my experiences here in Utah. But it was a long time ago. Wally, you remember, don't you? But I think our experiences were pretty heavily political. In fact, I think my organizing days were before I worked with you, Wally, on the political area. I remember my first time, I was working with the Sidney Hillman. I joined and helped with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And there was a fight between Hillman and Dubinsky and the Colby. He was the president of the ILG. And he called me, he says, Esther, Esther. He always called me Esther. We need a Mormon. And well, what do you need a Mormon for? Because there's some shops in Los Angeles, some garment shops, that are closing down and are moving to Salt Lake. And Rose Pasota was the big woman at that time in the ILG. And so I called Mother and LG, and they said they'd help take care of my kids. So I came out to organize. And it was the Utah Garment Company over on 2nd East West Maloof. Still stands, I think, the building. I went past it. But anyway, they were making house dresses. And I thought, how do I do it, you know? We had the NLRB. I knew the first thing that we had to do was get signatures. Signatures, so that we could have an election. So I started going around, and I started getting one or two names, and I would go over to find out where the women were having a sandwich at noon and sit down with them and get acquainted, which I did, and let them know who I was and from Provo and all the rest, but having grown up here all around. And got their names, began starting. So I began going from door to door for all of the women who were in the plant and got the signatures. But the interesting thing is my friends, I think we had a little good organizing committee within the plant, as you say. But the interesting thing is that they would come to me and just laugh, because the ward teachers, my friend, would follow me and say, "You must not listen to this outside agitator." And these women had more fun. They said, "She is, and she's a Mormon from Provo." So we really had quite a time during that time. And we did get a union. We did get a union. I shan't forget. And we had our celebration at the Hotel Utah. I thought, by darn, these girls are going to walk in that hotel with their head high and with their pretty dresses on. It isn't going to be just, you know, these are terrific women, and they were wonderful. So we got a good union. But I can't help but comment on this chasing. I've organized, but anyway, one of the organizations I've worked for was working at the Arrow Shirt in Troy. This does not relate to this Utah story at all, but later on we organized, and they closed down first thing you know, it's in New York, and then it went to Boston, then it went to New Jersey, it went to Utah, and you just followed. It was one right after the other all through. But when I was in New Delhi, years later, I was Assistant Secretary of Labor then, and I was helping them to help establish some labor standards in that country. I went in to a big garment plant making the fancy shirts that were making in Troy. What was the brand? I can't remember. Anyway, there's the standard the shirt, Arrow shirts. And went in there, and I looked over, and who do you think I saw? The foreman of the plant that we had just organized in Troy, New York. And he said, "Esther, what are you doing here?" And I said, "I came to organize you." And he said, "Oh, my God." Well, anyway, I've had some fascinating experiences in that whole area, and it is something that I believe in so strongly, and it's really what got me started heavily in the labor movement. So I think in answer to this, when the Colossus, you say that in the letter, that which is just and equal. Reading it in my book, in my hotel room, where I do read the Bible once in a while, anywhere, it also says, the second line is, knowing that ye also have a master in heaven. So I felt there's another little stop there. In my book, maybe the union is the interim. I'm not saying it's heaven, but what it is. But the point is, there has to be more than just that you want to do this. This has got to be much higher than that. And in the whole organizing area that I've felt, and here in Utah, I did a good deal of work politically, as Wally knows. And I was sent very early by Sidney Hillman during the early CIO PAC days to go to help her. And that's why Helen's book means so much to me. I want to thank her for her opening so much in the things that she has written and what she has taught me about all of that. And I'll never forget going on, Wally, what year was it when Wendell Willkie was running and would not follow FDR?
1940.
Well, that was the year I was there. And I was sent down there, and my job was really to see if I could switch, get the mine workers to support Roosevelt instead of Willkie. And I remember then, and it was not important. I found immediately that I had been a Mormon, or was, or I'm saying past tense, because they didn't like me because I was organizing in that time. And I'll never forget, the church idea was nothing. There were no Mormons in that group then. They were the Greeks and all of those that Yugoslavs and many of them that you had been talking about. But I'll never get going to this meeting and making my great strong plea. You know, I was a very fiery Democrat. I'll never get this president getting up and say, "Well, Mrs. Peterson, John L. Lewis is the president of our union." And I thought, here you go, Esther, you can't do it. He's the president of our union, and we follow him on union matters. He's not the president of our country, and we will support FDR. And, I remember sending a telegram to Sidney Hillman saying, I think that we're going to get this part, this part of it done. But to go back to the garment, to the organizing in Salt Lake, and I remember the Central Labor Body was so helpful to me, giving me names and all to have meetings and all the rest of it. I decided that I wanted to go on the radio. So I went to KSL, and I had a permission to buy time. And I kept track of the corporations that were buying time at that time, and I'll never get Campbell's Soup. So basically, I thought, now, this is a product. Surely I can buy some. And I went up, and who was the head of KSL in those days? I think it was Arthur Beeley or Beasley. Any of you remember?
What year?
In the 40s.
Earl
J. Glade.
Yeah. And he was succeeded by Ira
Sharp. I walk in there, and he had been a friend of my brother's. And the whole idea was that I was going to buy some time. And there, again, it came. He recognized me. I'd been the little kid running around the house when he used to see my brother Luther. And he said, "Esther, what are you doing here disturbing the peace?" And I remember that was the first expression of that I sort of remember about it. Well, anyway, my experience here certainly was that the church is anti-labor. And I think it still is, unfortunately. because I think it loses a tremendous amount of force that is needed today very, very badly. On the second question that you talked about, the similarities, definitely. In fact, I'm going to say tonight in my speech that the labor movement fulfills a great part in my life in the similarities of the kinds of things that we've worked for and that I've worked for a long time. And I think in relation to the question of loyalty, what I have felt here, and I felt it in Helper and I felt it around a lot of the places, the big decision I remember, more than some of these things that Ron and that you said, is that they were so afraid the allegiance to the church had to be so tight that there was a feeling that an allegiance to a union was dangerous. Isn't that? I felt that at our conference before, that it was strong. So it was a double allegiance that was difficult. I remember feeling hurt, I guess is the best way for me to say it, when I got acquainted later on with Frank Bonacci. Any of you remember him? And his wonderful family and the people that where the world opened up to me about Utah, which I had not known before. And I knew the suffering that they went through. I knew when they were thrown out. I know the stories of that time. And I was a grown person in Utah and didn't know it was happening. I look back on some of that and those wonderful, strong families that were outsiders and that we didn't see. I'll never get the stories, and you have said them too, that he was telling about the labor agents. And the church endorsed it, going out and recruiting people to come and do these jobs in it. So there's no question about it. There was that. I felt that, and of course in that early day there wasn't a right to strike, which is quite different than today. And it just seemed to me that in all of my experience, the church has always been on the side of management rather than on the side of what I call the people. I'm doing a lot of work at the United Nations these days. When you talk about the global part, we're working on the code of conduct for transnational corporations. And when I see the way we in our government are standing in the way of setting minimum ground rules for the foreign investment, it hurts. It hurts. I was coming back from Hong Kong the other day. How was that? I was. I was on this plane, and the person that was sitting by me was telling me about wonderful work that he was doing, how many countries he's going to, and making so much money, And I thought, well, gee, let me give you a few good causes you could be giving some of that money to that I know. And we kind of kidded about things like that for a while. So I asked him, how do you do it? He said, we make little gadgets, little things to go as prizes for a purina, and like all these, when you get a premium of some kind, we make that. And he said, I have factories in seven countries. I travel around, and I am making money hands over foot. And I said, why aren't you having those jobs here? Oh, I wouldn't make all this kind of money if I had to pay people here. 7 countries. And he flies around with his staff, picks up these models. Oh, why? There's a lot of handwork, and they won't do it. But these people love the money. It's more they've never had before. I know that as I go around the developing countries. They say, oh, don't take us away. I'll never get that shop in New Delhi. When I talked to the guy who was head of the women were sitting there, and he told me there that production was so low that the people were hungry. And he said they began feeding the women and bringing food, and production picked up. But then they found the women hid the food to take home to their children. And then you ask him, why don't they raise the wages? Well, it's just like one of the big shots in a hearing that I was at in Washington says, because we can get them for that. I'll never get Senator Tunnell, but we were working on minimum wage laws, asking about a certain position in the plan. Is it worth it? But how do you measure worth? And the guy just... Tunnel just pressed him up against the wall finally, and he said, oh, Senator, it's because I can get him for that. So that's what we have. Well, anyway, I think your answer, and we ought to get to questions, is mainly that it's political. Wally, I think we've got to go back to all the old political work again. It's who do we send to Congress, and who do we have that are making these laws? And when you talk about a future for the labor movement, tremendous future. When I go to some of these other countries and see how far behind we are on vacations, for example, how far behind we are on health insurance, how far we are behind on daycare, all of these things that are great things, that we should be leaders. We should be leaders. So there's so much to do that. And I also would say very high, and that's political. We have got to deal with the enforcement of the laws. We worked so hard to get OSHA, and it becomes worthless when it's done. What do they call it, law? Is a no law. An unenforced law is this. But I think political is the answer. So I'm an optimist. I'll hope to live to see the day. Oh, my Lord, will I? that I can say that the Mormon Church will look kindly upon those of us that believe as deeply as we do in the labor movement.
I couldn't help but chuckle a little bit when Kent quoted the phrase from, I think, the Deseret News that said that unions were violent, foreign-dominated, and anti-American. Anybody familiar with the history of the LDS Church in the 19th century would have seen those same three epithets thrown out toward the saints. Well, the time is yours. I think the way I'd like to do this is just ask Warren and Esther to come back to the microphone and just field the questions rather than me try to field them and then repeat them and say to them that you don't want to hear from me, you want to hear from them. And also, those of you who are participating here, if you have something you'd like to contribute, we would welcome that too. One thing that I couldn't help but thinking as I listened to what two of you had to say and what Kent said are some of the slogans from the labor movement that seem to strike a resonant chord in terms of my understanding of Mormonism. The idea that there is strength in unity, working together is how you accomplish things, that an injury to one is indeed an injury to all. All of those things to me seem to have some resonance. I still would be glad to hear from some of you here and the panel as well on why there seems to be this perception that somehow organized labor is something apart from the experiences of day-to-day Mormons. I think that the fact is that the church is anti-union. The question is, are individual Mormons anti-union? And I think the answer is sometimes and sometimes not. Well, anyway, I'd like to ask Warren and Esther then to come to the microphone and then open the... you field the questions and answer them. Open the floor to those of you here for questions or comments.
I hesitate a bit on this because my experience was so long ago here.
It was as recent as just last week. The issues are the same.
Well, I guess so.
Go ahead and just call and field.
That great Utahn, at least he was a Utahn for a little while, Joe Hill, at the end of his life, said, "Don't mourn, organize." And I think that's the answer. I believe that more is going on in a hopeful sense at the grassroots level than there is at the level of legislatures or Congress and so on. This doesn't mean that things are going to change and get better very soon, but what keeps me going as a labor person, or more than beyond just being a labor person, just an individual who's interested in a better world for my kids, is seeing that there have been, even in bad times, enough grassroots activity that have resulted in some real change, even if the overall picture is kind of bleak. For example, I think that in recent years, the labor movement has begun to turn around. And we saw in the early 80s that labor was just devastated, the aftermath of PATCO. And this ties in with the global economy and what Esther was talking about, these people, these transnational corporations saying, well, we can get away with it. We can make them work for next to nothing, and that's why we do it, and they do it. But I think in recent years we have seen that slowly things have begun to turn around. I refer to some very important strikes that have taken place. One is a place called Pittston Coal in Virginia. And in that situation, as well as so many in the 80s, the purpose of management, in a sense, forcing the strike, because that's what managements sometimes do these days, was to get rid of the union. And the union held firm, held tough. There was a lot of real old-fashioned solidarity. And basically, they won the strike. And that was, I think, a very important turn of events. More recently, we have seen the Eastern Airlines strike. And that wasn't a clear-cut victory for labor. It still isn't for sure. But at least Mr. Lorenzo, who was trying to bust the union, did not succeed in doing that. And he ended up kind of busting himself instead. And again, the reason why that situation turned out as it did was old-fashioned solidarity on the part of the labor movement. And I see also in Utah, I don't know if you've had the chance to hear Ed Main speak. Whenever you can, you should. He is the president of the Utah AFL-CIO. And he was able, through just sheer guts, to hold together an organization, the AFL-CIO, that was losing members all over the place because of the layoffs. And we survived, through his leadership, we survived the 80s, and even locally we're beginning to see some turnaround. We're beginning to see some increase in members and political results as well. So anyway, don't mourn, organize.
I agree with that, and I would only add to it, I agree completely with what you've said there. There are two things. I think that this movement, the grassroots movement that you talk about, is real. I think that's coming along. I feel it very definitely, not only in this country but in others. And I am tremendously interested in the growing consumer movement that is coming along. The people are beginning to understand, as users of goods and services, that they're beginning to see the relationship with that and the old Consumers League for Fair Labor Standards. It's fascinating how the relationship between those two things are coming. So I go back to Charlie Chaplin's film on the dictator. Do you remember?
Yeah.
When all these people are walking down the street and moving forward with something, and he comes back and says, wait for me, I'm your leader. And I have a feeling that that's just what's going to happen. I think the people themselves are going to wake up to it. That's one reason why I'm an optimist. This big conference I was in Hong Kong was an international consumer movement. They were there from 60 countries, and it was happening all over. It's a strong feeling.
For me? And the church ever did. The church demanded of me, and the union gave to me. But I also want to ask, who is Helen, and what is her book?
She's right there. Stand up. Helen Papadopoulos. And the title of your book was...
Oh, you mean my parents?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Emily George. My parents were Greek immigrants, and the book is their story.
And there's a strong part at the beginning about just her own entrance into the whole thing, too. It's a very good book.
Steve?
As you just kind of follow up about story of the women in India where they were providing meals to them, and then they found that women were taking meals home to their families. That struck a resonant note with me, because there are programs to feed children in this country, and that way we can ignore the rest of the problem for good because they're feeding kids. And one of the problems the group I'm involved with, we're doing a summer food site in Midvale, and the kids are required to eat that food on site by federal regulation. But the real problem is kids really do try to sneak away and take it home to their parents.
Right here.
They've just started putting cheese in the kids.
Right. And so, yeah, we scrambled up some cheese sandwiches to feed the parents.
Mm-hmm. Is ketchup still a vegetable?
No, but cheese is a 9-course meal.
Esther.
We're spending a lot of money. We have a division up at the state capitol for economic development to bring a lot of industries in here, presumably because we have a well-educated workforce. Presumably we'll work for lower wages. And I wonder, does anybody know about these companies that we're trying to bring in here? Do any of them have unions? Companies that are already established?
Yes, I don't know.
Okay. The one that's in the news right now is McDonnell Douglas.
But yeah. There are a lot of others.
Well, in the case of McDonnell Douglas, they have... They're organized in different places. One in St. Louis and one in Long Beach, California, the United Auto Workers. So, yeah, they've got lots of experience with unions.
On that point, I was a little interested in an anchor lady on one of the stations the other morning comparing the efforts made by some of the other states toward bringing McDonnell Douglas there rather than here. You know, they've got a big challenge to where they are finding them set up. This huge plant, they're talking about 30,000 acres, 25,000 people. I don't, maybe my figures are crazy, but it's a tremendous airplane factory. And she was relating to all the incentives that the other states are handing out to the chosen. And then she sort of smiled and said, but they don't have the right to work laws. Now, that's the tip-off to me. That
absolutely.
Shows the conspiracy. I'm not anti-Mormon. I'm not a Mormon, but I'm not anti-Mormon. I've been too much involved in politics to know where they're coming from, and they don't like leaving any other industry.
Absolutely.
It comes down to pocketbook is politics. Far as the fellow upstairs is pocketbook. The labor guys win their battles at the bargaining table, only to lose them at the ballot box. But getting back to the subject that whether or not McDonnell Douglas wins this thing and comes to Utah expecting the right to work law to help them build airplanes is just nonsense kind of an argument. The only thing, the right to work law doesn't give anybody a job. The only thing the right to work law says is that if you get a job, you don't lose it by having to join a union, which is an old closed shop argument, which went out the window in 1935 when the Wagner Act was passed. But they hang on to that, not for that. For two reasons. One, to give the employer the idea that they can hire more cheaply than this. Are there some press people in here today? Anybody press discovering this stuff?
I don't know.
Well, it's all right. The only thing the right to work law does is it minimizes the opportunity of the union to represent that 51% that they are required to say, we've got 51%, so therefore you have the right, you have a duty under both Utah law and federal law to now recognize us as the exclusive bargaining representative for this group. They don't care whether they join or pay dues. They just don't want any organization to be able to say, you got 51%, now Mr. Employer, it's an unfair labor practice for you not to recognize us and collectively bargain with the opportunity to sign a contract. So it's throwing that heavy weight around the neck of the union and the union organizers. Not to spare the free agency of the individual, because in this state, up until a year ago in July, we were still paying $2.15 an hour for minimum wages. In April of, when was it, last year or this year, it went to $3.50 and then $4.25. Not by reason of anything that our legislature or great leaders did, but federal government said that if interstate commerce is involved, you're going to have to raise that. And so we have these nice corporations all over handling fine, I don't mean nice in terms of the name of the corporation, but fine corporations come in here. 600-800 women taking those screen on telephone calls, now getting $4.50 an hour. They were going to get $2.35 for it before. Now they're getting $4.50. So, free agency and the right to work may have some magic that I don't understand. And of course, we come from a long line of believers that are still pretty close to the LDS Church. They got lost, as I imagine, when Ephraim went one way and Solomon went another.
There was another way.
But it just put the noose around the organizers. Yep. So we can't say I got 51%. Then we don't have to do business.
Doesn't it go back a little bit, the old Taft-Hartley?
Well, Taft-Hartley modified the Wagner Act. The closed shop went out. The closed shop went out between the 35 mm-hmm. and the 48. And they have what they call the union shop now. And in those union shop states that don't have 14B right to work, if you are in a union or a bargaining agent that is represented by 51%, then you have to join that union in order to hold your job.
Mm-hmm.
In Utah, that isn't the law. But the Railway Labor Act doesn't permit a right to work job. So all the guys that run the trains in Utah are under a non-right to work act. The airline people
just
are a different thing. So it isn't really consistent.
Yeah, but they don't stay long, right? They just pass through. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know, I'm thinking specifically of State Representative Magna, whose political base is the Steelworkers Union. He's a Democrat, but he's also a Mormon and a church leader. I believe he's a member of the State High Council where he lives. Do you know Mormons who put on one face in the Union Hall and another in the Stake Center that somehow or other don't seem to see this conflict? They somehow don't use the language of one position when they're in the other. They're all Mormon in here, and they're all Union in there. Have you run into experiences like that?
Sure. You
want
to take that one?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about, I guess.
I don't know anything about that.
The organizing campaign I told you about from Salt Lake, where we found an organizing committee with a number of active Mormons on it, and strangely enough, a number of vocally anti-Mormon people leading the company's anti-union campaign. Maybe that was an anomaly because the boss was so stereotypically, I'll use the word that the workers used, evil. They saw that the boss, who was non-Mormon, you know, fortunately from our point of view, they saw the boss as kind of an evil force, and they used that term. So my experience, I can't really help you with that one question, but if you took two people and one looked like a good Mormon and one looked like either a bad Jack Mormon or an anti-Mormon, and you say, which one is going to be for the union? Well, it would be the reverse of the stereotype. That was my experience. But that was just that one place, so I really can't go beyond that.
And then you're not familiar personally with other people who switch hats like that?
No. Are you? Maybe you can tell us about it.
That's one example I can think of.
I'm interested in the sort of political question. There's a lot of talk about what's happening to the Democratic Party, that the commitment to blacks and to women has alienated labor and all of that kind of thing. What kind of future do you see in the Democratic Party in the realm of politics, since several of your comments seem to suggest that that's where a big part of the future is?
It's the $64 question, really. But I think the thing is, right now, it's leadership. If we get a good candidate and get some leadership and more fearless people, I'm going to be optimistic there, too. We have simply got to stay under this kind of administration that we've been having. All of the downhill has been after the Democrats left the White House. The whole thing from Reagan, and I've lived through it. I've seen it, and I know it. And they're just not...
Who would be a good candidate, Esther?
You. Boy, there's a...
Is that who would
I
be
think
a good
that
candidate,
we'll,
Esther?
Certainly. Certainly some will come along. There are a lot of good people. We'll get one. But the point is, it's got to be... And also, it's not only that, but you've got to have a sentiment among the people. and a willingness to change and a willingness to build on some of these things. I think it'll be I think Harkin is saying awfully good things, and I like him a lot. I'd like him to put a little new oomph in it, some other ideas along with the other, if we could get them. I think there's a lot of wonderful people in the House. I think Neil Hamilton is superb. I worked with him on foreign affairs and on the local situation as well. There are a lot of good people. There's a lot of good people. How to get behind them, I don't know. Come on, Esther, you're good at this.
Why don't you mention what you said the other night about more of an international aspect to the Democratic Party?
Well, I think that they have to move into this, the international area, because that's the way we're moving. And my experience is that this administration is absolutely against moving at all in assisting in these areas. This thing that I'm working on the code of conduct for the multinationals, this administration uses the United Nations when oil is involved or something, but the minute you have it on an issue like this code of conduct, which would help on the international labor standards that we were talking about before, there is nothing. And I think that we've got to have a candidate that comes out strongly with part of this. But Esther, you had some good ideas.
Well, no, but I just noticed in the program at 7 o'clock that there's an Association for Mormon Democrats.
Oh!
So I hope all these people are going to be here. Yeah. And others as well.
It can be done, certainly.
Small room.
It's the same room. We can stay here.
I'd like to add one thing to what Esther said. And this is my editorial comment. I think that the Democrats' chances would be much better if they moved in the direction of what in other countries, including obviously England, is a Labour Party. You know, not to be afraid to speak unabashedly for workers' rights. I think what's happened with the Democrats is they've been so discouraged by turns of events in the last 15 years that they feel the only way to make any headway or turn things around is to be more like a Republican. And, you know, I don't think that's the way to go. I think the result of that course is simply to lose voters. The statistics show that the numbers of people actually voting are going down. So I think that even though this is not the accepted wisdom in the media, I nonetheless believe that a sort of a jumpstart approach where people who are pro-labor come out and say so and suggest policies that are, in fact, pro-labor and are not trying to hide that, I think that's where success lies. After all, the working people are in the majority. They get the money. The other side has the money, but the working people have the numbers.
Have the votes.
I think we've got time for one more question or comment. Maybe two. One to two, how's that?
You sound optimistic. I'm not very optimistic at all. I'm a sort of a labor person myself, Airline Pilot Association. I see what's happening on the national level. There is now currently a bill in Congress that looks like it's going to pass Congress, which will prohibit the employers from hiring permanent replacements for strikers. Bush administration will veto it. I promise that they will do that. But that act, the ability to do that negates the ability to strike effectively.
Right.
So without that, labor has no power.
That's right. Management can use that in organizing campaigns, which has been my experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you're not an equal partner and you take the permanent replacements, take away the equality between management and labor, yeah. And the answer, I go back to simply just organize. I think that
it's just going to have to be in on a political basis as well. And you ask why is the church non or anti-labor? Look at the background of the general authorities.
Yeah, we interesting series that came out in the paper a few weeks ago.
I've been teaching young people in college today for about 25 years. And during this time, I've seen a decline in optimism. It seems like the young people I talk to are so pessimistic. I'm a pessimist, heaven only knows, having lived 70 years. In some situations that can't be handled. But it's very distressing to me to see the young people say, by the time I get old enough, there won't be any Social Security. I can't buy a home. My permanent part-time is the only thing I can be hired for. And that's why I like Hester Peterson's optimism, if we could just get her generation to infuse it.
I almost just ache to get on a campaign. I could take one newspaper. You could take a newspaper every day and take the issues from that and make a hell-raising speech of all the things that is going on in the administration, the kinds of things. All you have to do is have the newspaper in your hand and take this and this and this and this. I think the trouble is the media. I don't think people are reading. I don't think they're thinking. I think they're using the sound bites. And have you seen that book, Amusing Yourselves to Death?
Yes.
Good.
Speaking as a teacher rather than just a labor person, what I see, the effect of the media is scary. Very scary. Not only what Esther says, there's the lack of reading and lack of thoughtful analysis, and we see even newspapers are trying to look like TV shows now.
Magazines.
And that's frightening. The irony of that is that the motive force behind that is profit. And we have these giant media corporations, Time Warner being Exhibit A. And if, going back to the question of values, if the value is to say, well, all those people with money must have that money, at least if they're in Utah, because they're good and they work hard, and we look up to those people, I don't know. What do the church authorities think about what the media have done? Obviously, they're against pornography and that kind of thing. But what the media has done goes beyond that. It has kind of shortened every neuron in young people's brains. They literally don't have the attention span. And so you have this tidal wave of little sound bites or dramatic pictures. Look at advertising. I think television commercials are the cultural epitome of our culture. And that's really scary. Mm-hmm. So if the thing that maybe I should be a pessimist after saying that, I mean, it's a battle. But the pessimistic side of me is pessimistic not because of political battles on issues like permanent replacements, but the media, the impact of the media. I think that's a giant fight that's going to foretell the outcome of this generation I see in school.
I agree.
That's the answer, too, because this is my ancestor. She's infused me now with so much energy. My question to you is what can we do? Give us a job. I want to enlist. I've been frightened too, and I feel I'm young, and I've been frightened about the future. But I want to know what I can do. And we get the kids away from exposed to all this media, and let's get them out doing something. And I think.
I'm just thinking of simple things. When you have these kids join the children's television